Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of October, 2015. Welcome to episode 4 of our ongoing long-term podcast concept. And that concept is just to have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes it pretty much the books I read during October. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those blogs to the Facebook and Twitter so you can find them. But those posts don't really count as spoilers for the podcast, because those are just lists, and here you get review, some critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Iowa's Joe Crawford commented that he also recently read the issue of Weird Western, which contained the debut of Cinnamon. I remember the house ads as a kid, but I had never read it before. Good series. I will definitely grab more if I find them. I may do the same thing, Joe. I really enjoyed that one. Canadian Rob Lance wished me and Emily a happy podcast day, which is September 30th, just so you can prepare for next year. Thanks for all the hours of enjoyment. You're welcome, Rob. Thanks for all the swag you've sent. Let's just say, this is not the last time we'll hear his name. Ruth and Darren Sutherland commented, or maybe just Ruth, maybe just Darren, maybe some strange hybrid they've assembled in their basement, I'm not sure, but whoever it was, they commented that listening to the show is like a time machine. It seems you're always talking about comics we read in the 80s and 90s. Case in point with this episode is Ms. Tree, which we're sure doesn't surprise you given our love of mysteries. No, I'm not surprised by that at all. It seems that every book I ever comment on that I like is also liked by the Sutherlands and or my Earth 2 counterpart, Jeff Nettleton. As always, thanks to everyone for the feedbacks. And now on to the books I read last month. As I've done in the prior episodes, I'm categorizing the books that I cover, and first are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. And a couple of books fit into this category. Night Mask, number 1. This is for an upcoming series on the Quarterbin, another Dead Universe series of episodes. This time it's Marvel's New Universe. Probably going to be 3 episodes, one for Night Mask, one for Starbrand, and one for... I haven't decided yet. Maybe I'll let listeners pick. That should be episode 63 of the Quarterbin, out sometime before Thanksgiving. I was big into the New Universe when it happened, and had pretty close to a full run of most, if not all of the books, so I'm looking forward to rereading some more and talking about them over on the other podcast. The Cross and the Switchblade. This one is not exactly for a podcast, but I did read it to blog about it on Darkness to Light, so I'm putting it here. Over the years, I've collected a dozen or so, maybe a few more, religious comics, Christian comics. I'm going to go through them and write reviews over there. So this was the first one, and that review is already up. So I will just mention it here, and if you want a longer review, check out darknesstolight.blogspot.com. The short version, not nearly as bad as I thought it would be. And then moving on to the new books that we read. I mentioned last month that all 4 of our new books came out on different weeks, which was pretty darn inconvenient. But now, these first 3 came out the exact same week, week 2 of the month, so thank you, DC Comics. DC Bombshells 3. We get more character introductions. We get Amanda Waller and Big Barda and a tease for Catwoman. More of the Joker's daughter and Zatanna, more Batwoman. And more of the seafaring trio of Mira, Wonder Woman, and Steve Trevor. I don't think we had Russian Supergirl this issue, though. We do get some plot advancement, which is needed at this point. It can't just be a series of name-checked female characters. And this issue we got an ugly Nazi demon thing. We did get the official start of Operation Bombshell. And we got Nazis blowing up our seafaring trio. On this one, I really like the globe-spanning nature of the title, but we do need to settle on a cast, even if it's a big cast, and just move into the telling of the story with that cast. I'm enjoying it. Conceptually, I dig out of continuity, alternate settings, alternate universe, Elseworld type of stories. Call it whatever you want. But this has been three issues of smaller vignettes, introductions, teases, and I do want this to take on a more traditional narrative turn soon. Starfire 5. Now, this is a series that has moved into this more traditional comic book narrative storytelling structure. They're still keeping it light and fun, at least in terms of the dialogue and Corey's interactions with the world around her and the people in that world. But we're also getting more mysterious, weird stuff happening in Key West, which is, of course, also not a surprise. But we also see that her pleasant life and her new job talking to dolphins is about to be seriously interrupted by a mean-looking dude from Tamaran, her home planet, who is looking to find her, probably to kill her. Constantine the Hellblazer 5. You think your ex gives you problems? Think they're a real monster? Well, it ain't nothing compared to the trouble that poor John Constantine's old girlfriend is giving him. For one thing, she's actually a monster. She is, in fact, the monster that's been killing the ghosts of his old friends. It seems like this was the end of the arc, so I don't know if DC is doing six-issue arcs for the trade, so there might be an epilogue to the story, or maybe a one-shot to fill out that schedule, or maybe they roll right into the new arc next issue. We'll see. I've really enjoyed that book. Also out that same week was the new Superman book coming out of Convergence, that Lois and Clark book. And Emily and I thought long and hard about it, but ultimately decided to trade weight for that one, unless we hear absolutely tremendous things about it. And if that's the case, maybe we'll go back and try to pick them up. But here's the thing. New comics are expensive, and we Middletons are kind of cheap. And we do want to give due consideration about the money we're spending on new comics. But I will say this. Everyone I know who has read this has nothing but good things to say about it. And these are mostly longtime fans of Superman, people who felt disenfranchised with, certainly disenchanted by, recent takes on Superman, certainly since the New 52 and probably for 5 or 10 years before that. But these Superman superfans have been very positive about this story. And I hope it sells well. I do hope it continues to be reviewed well. I don't have any illusions that DC will return to this type of Superman in their main title. And to be honest, I hope my Superman superfan friends don't have any illusions that that's what's going to happen either. This version of the character is not going to be the main Superman again, at least for a long time. Enjoy the book for what it is, and I hope it continues, and I hope it continues to be really, really good. The last new book of the month was Gotham by Midnight 10. Again, I won't talk in a lot of detail here because I'm reviewing this title on the Darkness to Light blog because of the presence of the specter and the sort of religious content that that implies. At this point, Jim Corrigan is in one big old mess from what's gone on in the prior issues, and Detective Drake is trying to get him out of town. The problem is that the Spectre is compelled to deal with sinners. And as she points out, if he ends up in Arkham or Blackgate, that could get real ugly real fast. And of course, I'm bummed that Gotham by Midnight is going bye-bye after issue 12, but I do hope that they're able to bring a good conclusion to the story. Fingers crossed. And on to some of the just regular reading that I did. Donald Duck 264. Probably got this one from Half Price Books, or maybe from World's Greatest Comics. Those are the places where I can find these 25-cent kid books. And, you know, during this year, I've read some Donald Duck, some Bugs Bunny, some Archies, and a bunch of these kids' books from decades gone by. In general, you know, on average, I think the Donald Duck issues may be the best. This one had Donald buy a piece of property, basically at first sight, and then open a successful restaurant there, only to find out that the land is about to be made uninhabitable by a big dam project. a project building a big dam, I should have said. It was a legitimately funny story, and the rest of the issue was strong, too. Edge, 1 through 3. Stephen Grant and Gil Kane are solid creators, but this miniseries was put out in 1994, so, yeah, the costume is overdesigned. The action is extreme! And there are lots and lots of chains on the cover to issue 1, especially. It was a 4-issue mini from Malibu, from their Bravura line, and it felt like a 90s book, trying really, really hard to be a 90s book. And I don't mean those as compliments. The first 2 issues were quite confusing. Seemed like they were trying to cram a lot of backstory and political history and family drama into the issues to lay the groundwork. And there was a lot of backstory to fit in, which is good. I mean, I kind of liked the story. It was about scientifically enhanced folk becoming the sort of official super team of this world. But Edge rebels against that and turns on his team. By the way, it was his father who was the scientific genius behind the plan. So you have built-in emotional drama of that nature. And I liked all of that. But maybe there was a different way to communicate all of that backstory. So I was not impressed by issues 1 and 2 overly. But number 3, on the other hand, was surprisingly strong. Maybe surprisingly because of how meh 1 and 2 were. It was telling more of a standard comic book story in a more comic book manner, and I enjoyed that. These were issues I found when Emily helped with my Labor Day comic book reorg project. These are books I pulled out to read, figuring I would not put them back in the collection. And I'm going to stick with that assessment. The series is going to go in the giveaway pile or something, partly because I don't have issue 4, but also because I got through issue 3, and as more enjoyable a read it was than the first 2, I thought to myself, nah, I don't really need to finish this series. I think as comic book fans, you know what I mean by that. And All-Star Squadron Annual, number 3. To my mind, this one is a modern classic. It's the one where Ian Carcool has learned the names of all the future U.S. presidents and sends supervillains out to kill them all across time. It has been covered many times on podcasts, very recently by Ed Moore on his Dr. Fate show, Lords of Order. So I'm not going to talk much about the issue here, but I did want to talk about how I got the issue. This one came my way from the great Canadian listener, Rob Lance, and when I posted a picture of all the stuff he sent, Gregor Rujo said that he had been hounding the cheap bins for this one. So I sent it off to him with a couple other books. And then a little bit later, Greg sent me some stuff. Circle of comic book life and all that. Other ones that I read that came from that Rob Lance package included Captain America, number 5. This is an old one from all the way back in 1981. Cap goes up against a veteran with some issues, a man who can't recapture the excitement of seeing battle. So he decides to team up with a former comrade who really likes to watch people get killed. Sort of like reality TV via Faces of Death. Gene Colan's pencils are a strength of the issue, which was otherwise a pretty forgettable one-off. Some interesting visuals. There's even an eerie reference to the Twin Towers being a really great terrorism target. About 20 years before 9/11. Freedom Fighters 12 and 14 was also in that pack. I had all 15 issues of this title when it came out in the 70s, but it did not survive one of the many purges and sell-offs of my collection in the decades that followed. But I have pleasant memories of the title. Of these two, number 12 was okay, it was fine. But I really liked number 14. This is the one that takes place at an amusement park, which is, of course, a classic Silver and Bronze Age location for an adventure. It also features guest appearances by Barbara Gordon and Kathy Kane. You've got heroes on the run, the amusement park setting, guests. It works. I really enjoyed that one. He also sent Meanwhile, number 1 and 2. This is a new British comics anthology that, for me, is mostly about Strangehaven, which I've talked about here before, Rob sent me the three trades of that title, but the story ended, and that was more than a decade ago, so there seemed no hope that the story would ever get finished. But this new title, this new anthology, was able to draw Gary Spencer Millage back to Strangehaven to continue, and fingers crossed, hopefully complete, the Strangehaven story. One nice thing about the story here is that it was fully colored. While it was black and white in its prior incarnation as a standalone, totally indie self-pub title. Our main hero, Alex, barely appears in either of the first two installments, which were here each about 16 pages, the longest stories in both Meanwhile issues. The second one was almost exclusively about Adam, the resident alien of the town, as in the guy in town who claims he was from outer space. He has rebuilt his quote-unquote spaceship and his quote-unquote communications array to his homeworld, and so I guess that's the direction the story's going in from here. Meanwhile, also had a few other ongoing stories, including 10 Minutes by Yuko Rabbit. This is a totally high-concept sci-fi story in a world where the entire gravity of the planet is held in place by one girl who has to be held captive in a tower. Her new caretaker understands that the rules give her 10 minutes of freedom at a time, and he's trying to figure out how to best utilize that to show some kindness to the girl and, you know, not destroy the world. The Bad Bad Place by David Hine and Mark Stafford, about a strange Victorian house that appears one night in that eerie, vacant lot on the weird side of town. So these two issues of Meanwhile are a mix of ongoing serialized stories and one-shots. Of the one-shots, the one I really liked was Melody Baker by Chris Geary. Futuristic lady spy. She has set the explosive charges, but can she escape before they go off? These issues have 52 pages of story and are on extremely high-quality glossy paper. They much more resemble magazines than comic books. My first thought when I picked up an issue for the first time was, wow, this book is heavy. They do run $7.95, or in England, £4.95, so it's a bit on the high side, but definitely an interesting effort. And like I said, 52 pages of story, so the math does actually kind of work out. No superheroes in there, by the way. Just a very eclectic mix of fantasy, sci-fi, and other oddball types of stories, some of which bordered on underground type of comics. So again, a very eclectic mix. I mentioned the books that Greg Arujo sent, and out of that pile, I read Ghost Rider 2099, number one. In terms of the 2099 books I've read, Ghost Rider is pretty far from the Doom and Spider-Man side of the spectrum, if you know what I mean, and unfortunately closer to the Ravager side of the 2099 world. Maybe the cyberpunk motif was more timely at the time. And I've talked about this when covering Doom 2099 on the Quarterbin, but when you're 20-plus years after the book was published, but 80-plus years before it takes place, and we've already passed the future technology that was being hypothesized, that's just one of the big risks you run in that type of neo-futuristic storytelling. I think that's a good place to take a break after a promo for a podcast that I highly recommend. I'll come back and talk about the trade paperbacks I've read, and a new special feature, and a memorial tribute.
Okay, Bill, are we ready?
Sure, Paul. Oh, wait, be right back. I need my Avengers omnibus. Where did I put that thing?
While Bill looks for that, let me tell you about our new endeavor. Two True Freaks has grown, and Back to the Bins is growing with it. I, Paul Spataro, along with Bill Robinson and Scott Gardner.
Just say his name three times in an email and he'll appear in your show.
Hey, how's it going?
Sorry. I forgot I had a Scott Gardner life model decoy in here. Be right there. Ow! Ow, who put Cap Shield there?
Anyway, we're looking to showcase various characters, storylines, issues, or whatever strikes our fancy from the world of the Avengers.
Hey, Ben, move that funny-looking hammer, would you? It's It's on that book, and I can't move it.
Sure thing, Dad. Where do you want it?
Over there somewhere. No! Watch out for the repulsor! Ow! Oh! Ah! Ah! Don't tell your mother.
We like to call it Avengers Spotlight.
I thought it was going to be called Old Avengers Never Die. They just get reassembled and sent to another Earth. What? Too wordy?
Who knows what we'll cover, and who might stop by?
So join us for the Avengers Spotlight, where we'll look at Earth's greatest heroes and some of comics' greatest stories, such as the Korvac Saga, Acts of Vengeance, the Kree-Skrull War, and, oh, for the love of Christ, who the hell put the Celestial Madonna Saga on this list?
Huh. I found a use for that life model decoy after all. Okay, found it. We ready? Hey, wait a minute. This is the Book of the Vashanti.
Forget it. See you soon, everybody.
My favorite Avengers are D-Man and Green Lantern.
Say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
And we're back. And next up, the trades and graphic novels that I read. Hawkeye Volume 1. This is the Matt Fraction series with most of the art by David Asia. It covered Hawkeye 1 through 5 and the issue of Young Avengers Presents number 6, where Clint met the young Hawkeye, Kate Bishop. We may end up talking about it thematically, or at least talking about specific aspects of this run in an upcoming short box showcase. It'll probably be the next trade or the trade after, so I'm safe to talk about it here. And not surprisingly, I really, really like this. It's a critically acclaimed run, and was strong right from the beginning. The basic premise is that it's the life of an Avenger when he's not being an Avenger. But he's still a hero, that comes through loud and clear. And the relationship with Kate Bishop is great. There's a real nice friendship there, at least at this point, that's what we have in the first five issues. The entire run, the entire Matt Fraction run, is the most modern, the most recent item to land in the Marvel Top 75 Stories list that they assembled last year. Blaine Dowler talked about this on episode 49 of his unofficial Marvel Top 75 countdown. There is, of course, some really good stuff in here. We get Clint getting his dog. We have his early run-ins with the Russian mob, a.k.a. the Tracksuit Mafia, in terms of protecting the people in his building from their unwanted attentions. And also issues 4 and 5 are The Tape, a really good international espionage thriller type of story. Those two issues look slicker than the first three because there was an art change there. Asia's stuff was a little grittier, I guess, a little off, sort of in the Cliff Chang Wonder Woman way, but maybe not totally that far. But I really like the vibe that he brought to those New York-based stories. Javier Bolido brought a slicker, more traditional comic book for the last two issues that he did. Again, really liked the stories. The praise that this run, that this trade gets, is really well earned. I also read the Dollhouse trade, based on the Joss Whedon TV show. The trade collected a one-shot and then the five issues that followed up. They didn't present this as Dollhouse Season 3, as the Whedon team does with Angel and Buffy, but that's pretty much what it is. It just wasn't branded that way. The issues did not resemble the regular episodes of that show at all. It clearly takes place as a long storyline after the end of the finale, which ends up with a post-apocalyptic vibe. It picks up at that point and continues the long myth of the series. And it does a decent job at it. It's a pretty good read. Probably better than the TV show was on average, just between you and me. I've talked about the issue of likenesses before in licensed property, but boy, did they do a great job here. Alan Tudyk, Felicia Day, Eliza Dushku, they all look like their characters, and that's not easy. They talked about the likeness process in the back matter and showed various sketches and designs that they used to get the performer's approval, and that is an extra feature I haven't seen before in a collected edition. And it was an interesting one. I like when trades bring in any type of special back matter, especially if it's something that's a bit out of the ordinary like this was. I also read a nonfiction OGN, Lone Hawk, The Story of Air Ace Billy Bishop, by John Lang. Bishop is a Canadian war hero. And of course, this book got to me via Canadian listener Rob Lance. It was a crisp, clear, easy-to-read book telling Bishop's life story. I can envision plenty of 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds across Canada reading this as a supplement in their history class. The story jumped around a little bit. The standard comic book storytelling wasn't particularly strong. But I do think it was targeting students mostly, like I said. So telling good history was probably the priority than telling a good comic book story, if you know what I mean. And that history is really intriguing. And the art is particularly strong. It's in black and white. And the figures still manage to be distinct. And they are very consistent. That's sometimes a struggle I have with black and white, that sometimes the characters can blend together if they don't have that pop of color, be it hair color or clothing choices, that can distinguish them. But that was not an issue with Lang's work here. I don't know if I've mentioned that it's a World War I story, and the planes looked great, the dogfights looked great. This is the pilot with the most air victories in Canadian military history. And he became such a symbol of Canadian military's strength and their participation in the war effort that he was called back to Canada before the end of the war to become like a public speaker and a fundraiser for the war effort. He was such a great asset to Canada on the home front that they didn't want to risk him being killed in action, which is a really interesting take. I really enjoyed this. I hope it is or will become standard fare for Canadian school children. Trekker by Ron Randall, the wonderful Darren and Ruth Sutherland, who I may have moderately made fun of earlier in the episode, but which was purely in love, sent me the Trekker Omnibus recently, signed by Ron Randall. And they sent a Trekker trade to Emily as well, because they are awesomely awesome people. So of course, I have to reread the stories one by one, and after each one, re-listen to their Trekker Talk episode about that story. So this month I got caught up, reading about half the omnibus, the first 7 or 8 stories. So I'm going to take the stories slower now, waiting for each episode to come out to read the next story. So I blasted through the first half of the trade, but the second half of the trade will be much slower in coming. Again, for details on the stories, check out Trekker Talk. But briefly, it's a book I totally missed when it came out, but is totally right up my alley. Retro future sci-fi setting, Lady Bounty Hunter, really, really enjoyable storytelling. And the black and white art is terrific as well. A great find. Thanks, Sutherlands. Way back after episode 1 of this podcast, listener Ron Sadowski wrote in with a suggestion. You probably know Ron as the brains behind the Dinner for Geeks podcast. And he commented that my blog includes comics and books that I've read, and thought maybe I should include book reviews here as well. And this is actually a pretty good point, especially now that the Book Guys show has gone on, let's say, long-term hiatus. There's actually rumors of a Book Guys show reunion, at least for a one-off episode coming up. Not sure that's going to happen, but you never know. So I have decided to talk about not every book I read, but books that are directly comic-related, for sure, and maybe some other sci-fi or genre books that I read too. Let me know what you think about that. And I've got one for this month, the novel Sable by Mike Grell. Keen-eared listeners will know that I'm a huge fan of Grell, and John Sable may be my favorite of his creations. Certainly his John Sable Freelance series, the original 56 issues from First Comics, ranks right up there with Doom 2099 as my favorite comic series ever. But don't tell anyone in Latveria I said that. The novel basically tells the origin story of the character as presented in the first 6 issues of that original John Sable Freelance title. I haven't read those original issues in decades, so I can't say to what extent the novel held true to the details of that earlier version, left things out, expanded, etc. I don't think I said this, but the novel was published about 15 years after those issues came out. And it certainly hit the broad outlines of the John Sable storyline, which is that Sable was an American Olympian competing in the pentathlon, which is a combined event made up of swimming, running, horseback riding, archery, and shooting. And I think the time frame would be the 1976 Montreal Olympics. He came in fourth, but also, while he was there, fell in love with a South African gymnast, who he followed to her country and courted and married and eventually had two kids. They opened a safari business, but the turmoil in South Africa in the 1980s hurt every tourism-based business. So he ends up becoming a game warden battling ivory poachers. He was quite aggressive in this new job, and the poachers decided to teach Sable a lesson by roughing up his family. But things got out of hand, the house burned down, and his wife and kids were killed. Sable dives into the bottle, sobering up long enough every now and then to take a job as a mercenary. But all the time, he's also looking for info about who exactly ordered the kill on his family. Early in his marriage, Sable had sent a novel manuscript to a bunch of New York publishers and agents, trying to turn his adventures into fiction, like a men's action-adventure book. The only positive response he got was not about the main novel, but about the bedtime stories the main character tells his kids. The agent, Eden, says that if he works on these stories of leprechauns in New York City, she could probably get that published. This opportunity brings him back to the U.S. and begins his second career as children's book author. But the past reaches out to him, and he has to decide if heading back to Africa to track down his wife and kid's killer is what he needs to do or not. One of the things that Grell does great here is tell a complete story. The novel has resolution. It does bring in the elements of comics that become the ongoing story. The stuff in New York, the children's book author, his sort of secret identity. In the novel, he turns that into a nice bit of character building, where in the comics, it's obviously laying groundwork for future plot elements. I really enjoyed this novel, I have to say. And from what I can tell, this is Grell's only work of prose fiction, at least that I could track down. And I conclude this episode on a somber note. Comics legend Murphy Anderson passed away a few weeks ago at the age of 89. A group of podcasters decided to include some coverage of Anderson into upcoming episodes to the extent that they could. Quarterman episodes were pretty well locked down, to be honest, so I thought the best way I could contribute to that effort was to read a few of the stories that he contributed to and talk about them here. Superman 254, cover date of July 1972. I have had this book for a long time. I don't think from 1972, because I moved to and from overseas after that, and I didn't think I took any comics with me. I did bring some back, but a very limited number. Because what I've said elsewhere, moving costs are based on weight, and paper is really heavy. But me and Wade and Peter, we traded comic books back and forth so many times, in 75, 76, 77, that I'm guessing I got it from one of those fellas and brought it back with me from overseas. So whatever the details are, I am pretty sure that this is the single comic issue that I've had in my possession longer than any. And it's got all the right elements. A story by Denny O'Neill and art by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. The story is the kid who stole Superman's power. And it's a wild little sci-fi thing in the early 70s sort of way. An alien invasion is thwarted with the help of a sick kid at a hospital and his telepathic links. Yes, I did just say all of those words. And of course, this is absolutely classic Swanderson art. And so to my mind, Superman looks the way Superman is supposed to look. I'm not going to go so far as to say that this version is my Superman. That's just not the way I think about any comic book characters. But I do think that this classic 60s and 70s look has a lot going for it. It really works for me. The shape of the face, the body type, the capage. It's all classic. One of the legendary art teams in comics. Also read Superboy and the Legion 245 and 246 from November and December 1978. 245 is an extra-length Paul Levitt story featuring one of the Legion's great bad guys, Mordru, ending a four- or five-issue storyline. And it's Joe Staton that Murphy Anderson is teaming up with on the art. And to the listeners of the excellent Super Future Friends podcast, yes, there was tunneling. Multiple episodes of tunneling. Mordru, as a character, is physically large, and the scale issues between him and the other characters were handled really impressively. There was a lot of dynamic action, including between different sized characters. And obviously the Legion has a huge cast of characters. And for the most part, it really worked. And no surprise, Superboy looked really good. The next issue, 246, Anderson and Staton team up again, this time in a backup story written by Len Wein. Well, I call it a backup story, but it was really the start of the next storyline, as this is what continues into the next issue, which is weird, but I've run across this a few times with books from the 70s and 80s, where the first story in the issue wraps up, and then a second story appears, what we would think of as the backup, but that's the story that launches the next adventure and is continued into the next issue. It does really take the idea of lead story and backup story and totally makes that distinction meaningless. On the story itself, it was the Fatal Five versus three Legionnaires on a distant planet land. And so again, lots of opportunity for scale and action and landscape. Very solid. And again, Superboy looked really good. Like I said, a lot of other podcasts will talk about Anderson, and I imagine in much more depth than I've been able to hear. Some of those may have already happened, and some may be planned to come out later in November. Ryan Daly is planning to cover Murphy Anderson's work on Flowers and Fishnets, but also Back to the Bins, Comic Book Time Machine, Task Force X, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun, are all planning tributes, as are plenty of other shows, I'm sure. So condolences to Murphy Anderson's friends and family, a classic comic book artist. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Starfire 5 was really good, as was the first issue of Meanwhile. That last one was partly a matter of expectations, probably, not knowing what I'd get, but the Strangehaven installment was solid. Some of those Trekker stories from the Omnibus were also really good, and of course, the Hawkeye stories are great in that first trade as well. So I've got to say, it was a really good month of reading for me. But in terms of a favorite issue, I may have to go with Superboy and the Legion 245, that Mordru issue. He's a great villain. It was the end of a long story, a satisfying conclusion, and this is one of the eras where the Legion was really, really good. And I was able to pull this one from my collection easily because I've owned this exact copy of this issue since 1978. I think my reading will continue to drop a little bit as the semester wears on, but I'm confident that I'll have enough for a new episode next month. Should be out the first week of December. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them, and what you think of adding book reviews where, you know, the book is on topic for the show. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode, the blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.